This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do. I am very pleased to introduce you to Kirsten Pagosh, who is the author of a book entitled Leaving the OCD Circus, Your Big Ticket Out of Having to Control Every Little Thing. Kirsten, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you so much, Pamela. I really appreciate being here with you.
Well, I have to say, Kirsten, that the way that the book is even literally physically laid out and all the candor with which you describe your journey was really one of the things that struck me right off the bat. So let's just start with explaining the title, Leaving the OCD Circus. What is OCD?
Well, OCD stands for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. And essentially what that is, obsessions are thoughts that you can't stop having, and compulsions are the things that you do to try to stop the thoughts, even if it's temporarily. And I came up with Leaving the OCD Circus because what I experienced through my 22 years of non-diagnosed OCD was a very hellish, nightmarish circus, and my journey was about finding my way out of the circus and sharing that with everybody who's interested in the book and learning more.
You start off with describing what the OCD experience felt like for you. And I'd like to hear about your beginnings, but I'd like to put all of this in perspective for those who are unfamiliar with this diagnosis or this experience. You start off describing your experience with a house of cards and a gun. What, tell us about that description and what that means.
Well, I think that OCD is in our common vernacular now much more so than when I was struggling at my worst. And oftentimes what I hear is people misunderstanding OCD or joking around about it or saying, oh, I prefer things a certain way, I'm so OCD. And it really isn't a joke, and it's not lofty or light at all to the sufferer. And the nature of it is as though you're trying to build a house of cards. You have a fan on that's blowing the cards over, and then you have this authoritative voice that theoretically is holding a gun to your head, forcing you to build the house of cards. So you can see it's a never-ending loop where you're never going to get things just right and get the OCD to stop unless you learn about OCD and learn how to manage the gun, the fan, the cards, and all the like.
You know, as I think about the description, you can almost feel the anxiety and the frustration. You got the cards, you're building a house, there's a fan blowing it all down. I mean, it just feels frustrating and anxiety-provoking, even as you describe it.
Yes, and that was intentional to do my best with words to try to express to people the level of anxiety that you would feel, the level of feeling trapped that you would feel not being able to get out of this going nowhere kind of loop.
Kirsten, let me ask you this. The childhood that you experienced, it sounds like it was a really challenging, difficult one. So let's start with where you were born and who was living in the house with you as you were born.
Well, when I was born, it was in 1966 in California. And when I was about 1 year old, my parents, both being teachers, got jobs in Illinois. And so that brought our family to Illinois. And due to a variety of circumstances, my mother and father got divorced when I was 2.5. So I kind of had two different worlds going on. One, which was with my mother and very conservative, and the other one with my father, which was, if I can say, dark and chaotic and incredibly challenging, especially for youth.
Well, now that you've described it in that way, I need to ask you a little bit more about what that means.
Well, my father, although he had many wonderful traits, now that I've kind of learned more about my life and my journey, I fully believe that he not only was a sociopath, but also a very heavy narcotics user. And so that makes for a very challenging environment for a little person to feel safe in.
That sounds pretty scary. Can you give us an example of behaviors that were typical for your dad?
Sure. And I enjoy the band Pink Floyd, so I have nothing negative to say about them. However, when I was a little girl, he would have his parties in the house that would take place in the living room, and he would bring in all of his friends. It was the 1970s. They would all be tripping on acid, smoking a lot of pot, listening to very loud music, watching geometric shapes on the screen in front of them. And for me, it was incredibly unsettling. It was not really a party that a child should have been anywhere near.
Not at all. It sounds really horrifying, actually, as I picture it as you're describing it. Were you actually permitted to be a part of the party, or did you simply hear it in other parts of the house?
I was able to be a part of it because I was sort of like an appendage to my father. But it was all about the adults having a good time, and I would be in the bedroom right next to where all this was taking place with a warped wooden door that wouldn't close. And even though I was sitting in the dark in the bedroom, I was hearing all of this madness going on the outside of the door.
So as a little one, I mean, that just, it was a party for your dad and his friends, but it sounds really scary for a little one.
It definitely was, and I really think when OCD kind of crept into my life when I was about 9 years old, it appeared almost as a friend because it gave me a real sense of control and a sense of stability that inside I wasn't feeling. So I would start to control my exterior environment to try to feel like I had things under my control rather than speeding out of control.
Now, your birth father committed suicide, and your stepfather was a challenge himself, correct?
Well, my biological father did not commit suicide. He actually passed away in his sleep.
Okay.
However, there is a suicide in our family, which was from my mother's first husband.
Okay. So again, more chaos in the family. If it affects the mom, it certainly affects the household. Did you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have two older brothers that actually came from the marriage of my mom and the poor gentleman that took his life. But those are my big brothers that I grew up with in my mom's house.
At 9 years old, something happened that, or some numbers of things were happening that pushed you towards the experience that you have now identified as OCD. Was it more of what you've described? Was it more intense than that? What was going on?
Well, oftentimes people try to figure out the source of OCD, and my belief is that it's nature, kind of the DNA that you're born with, and then kind of nurture, the type of environment that you were in. And so I had the double whammy, if you would. And it appeared one day my father was dropping me off back at my mother's house after a long weekend of his partying and so forth. And I could remember a voice in my mind, kind of an authoritative voice, that said, "Hey, do you want to play a game? You can tap out to a certain number, and I'll offer you some form of relief," which for me it would be peace of mind or being at ease. And so that was the beginning of the game, and I thought, sure, you know, I'll give it a whirl. And I remember tapping on the car a certain amount of times and then having to do it again to make it more perfect.
So, in fact, this was a way to help you to be calm and secure, even if just for a moment.
Absolutely. It's a very temporary relief that's offered with OCD. However, at the time, I just thought, huh, this is kind of an interesting thing that I'm doing here, and it offered a distraction from my regular life, and it gave me something that I could apply myself to be successful at. And that was kind of OCD's first big step in the door.
So, Kirsten, you sort of had this sense that if you played this game that really required intense focus, it would serve the purpose of taking you away from the chaos in which you were living in that moment. So that kind of seems like it might have been a good thing, yes or no?
Yeah, I think when OCD first arrived, I saw it kind of as a friend, kind of an interesting distraction that had things for me to do. And then as time progressed, this inner narrator would show up more often, and the games became less like games and more like drills that you would get from a sergeant. So right away, the OCD started to morph, if you will.
And as you grew in this experience, what began to change? Did the tapping game remain the same? Were there other games, other activities?
Well, I think because it came into my life so young, my OCD has taken many manifestations. And, you know, I would say to give you more of an idea of the type of OCD that I have or have had, definitely the counting, repeating things in my mind, a checker, so I check and double check and triple check things over and over again, and also a perfectionist. So it kind of took a lot of different forms. And although the book, in the beginning of it, it's a memoir, and I described to you what my OCD was like, about the halfway point, it becomes a self-help book. And that really is a self-help book for anybody experiencing OCD in any manifestation. I give tips and techniques and things that you can start doing right away to start reaching your freedom and start reaching your potential a lot faster than I was able to get to mine. But I'm sure you've heard of compulsive hand washers. There's people that are horribly terrified of contaminants and germs. And although I was very debilitated, there is such extreme cases of people literally not leaving their house, not being able to function at all. And the book I wrote is for someone on the spectrum that has OCD, but also can have incredibly extreme, debilitating OCD. I wanted to put something together that would reach the OCD sufferer and also those that love them that are trying to understand it better.
Well, certainly at the end of the book, what you do is to offer a list, if you will, of what are some common experiences for those dealing with OCD. And you don't say that it's a complete list. You simply suggest that these are some things that happen perhaps more often than others. And you talk about contamination and losing control and having to be perfect. And you also bring up unwanted sexual thoughts and religious obsessions, which, you know, for the folks who are dealing with those, are really horrifying to deal with.
Right. And if you had a knob, if you will, to turn down the volume, you would do just about anything to stop the obsessions. And that's where you start doing the compulsions that are very secretive, and you realize this is really weird stuff that I'm doing. However, I can't stop myself from doing them.
So it almost sounds like an out-of-body experience. You know that what you're doing, or at least you have a sense of what you're doing and thinking and feeling, is not within the normal experience for other people, but you also know that you can't stop.
Right. And I guess, Pamela, I would say that everybody has an inner narrator. that kind of maybe comments or critiques on things, the voice that you hear in the head. However, with OCD, it's the voice of your own mental disorder. It's the voice of your chemicals off balance. So it's very important for the OCD sufferer to know that it is not their fault, and it's actually a medical condition where the fear center in your neurons, in your brain, are misfiring. And so it's actually a real thing, that there are real things you can do to make your life much better.
I think that's such a critical point that many people don't know. I mean, certainly what we do know is that in our society, very often when people find a label attached to themselves, they also find a lot of judgment. And sometimes it's internal judgment, but judgment nevertheless. And so that you were able to point out specifically that this is a disorder, you didn't create it, but there are things that you can do to feel better and be better, is such an important part of what you offer in leaving the OCD circus.
Well, thank you. And I tried to make it a kind of a multi-platform learning experience. And so, yes, there's words and storytelling in the book. However, there's also pictures and there's poetry. And I'm just an artistic soul, and that's kind of how I was able to pull all the material together to really speak to the reader on a very deep level.
Kirsten, who was the sergeant?
Well, the sergeant is, and that's a very interesting question, Pamela. When I was a child, until I was finally diagnosed with OCD, I did not even know those letters together. I've never heard them together. And I thought, when I'm writing about this time in my life, I can't talk about this strange, mercurial thing and not have a name for it. So I thought long and hard, and I thought, what is the best word I can give this voice of OCD? And I thought a sergeant, you know, someone that says, off the floor, maggot, or more sit-ups, or whatever. And for me, it was a military sergeant that was just unrelenting and would not let up.
And when one thinks about a sergeant, one hardly thinks about warm and fuzzies.
Absolutely. And I'm sure there's many wonderful people that do all kinds of things in the military.
Right.
But the force that I was dealing with was one, like I said, that was unrelenting, unfair, unjust, and quite frankly, really had it out for me.
And was with you all the time, is my guess.
Yes, and I think as my illness progressed, it was with me more and more. So when I was 9 and I was saying that it was kind of like a friendly voice, I was not diagnosed until I was 32 years old. And so I got pretty darn deep in the trenches of my illness, and I really had no idea what was going on, why it was happening, how to get out. I was incredibly isolated. There'd be times I would just fall on the floor crying, unable to function. And it wasn't until my husband actually heard a PSA on the radio where someone from the International OCD Foundation put together this public service announcement that said, hey, do you or anybody you know suffer from, and then they went on to describe OCD. And my husband sat up and thought, oh my gosh, this is what we're dealing with. It has a name, and we need to find out more information about whatever this OCD thing is.
The fact that your husband characterized it as something that we were dealing with is so important. And even though I don't know your husband, I appreciate the fact that that's how he responded to hearing that information. Kirsten, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Leaving the OCD Circus. Kristen, as you were going through these challenges within yourself, did anyone around you notice what was going on, that you were behaving in ways that were troublesome?
Well, that's an interesting question, too, because on the outside, some of the things I was doing as a child looked pretty good because I kept my bedroom perfectly neat and straight. I kept my sock drawer with, you know, tiny little white sock balls all shaped the same way. The colored ones were separate. I was constantly dusting my room, and I wanted to have complete control over every single item in my room as well as all the spaces in between. So for an onlooker, you'd say, oh my gosh, how did you get such a great kid that really is so conscientious and has such a beautiful, clean room all the time? And that didn't really indicate the suffering that I was going through, that I had no other way to live. And if I didn't do things a certain way, I was convinced that catastrophic things would happen. So I was always performing to make certain that my loved ones wouldn't be harmed, my animals wouldn't be harmed. And also with OCD, and I like to share this too, if you're someone who wins a triathlon, you want to share your medals and you want to share all the things that are going on because you're a winner and things are great. And when you have OCD, it's such a personal, private, hellish existence that it's nothing that you're proud of that you want to announce on a loudspeaker. On the contrary, you kind of have this double life going on that you keep very, very secretive, which allows OCD to, quote unquote, stay in power, if you will.
I think that that's a very important explanation to offer, and I thank you for that. I'm wondering, as you became older and you're now in high school, I mean, we know that high school can be a bear for all kinds of reasons for, I think, everybody who's ever gone through high school. How was it for you?
Well, I had all the things that were going on with other teenagers. You know, do I fit in? Am I pretty enough? You know, will I get asked to the dance? And all the things that we might get ourselves worked up about or maybe focus on. But I had the double whammy because I also had this internal dialogue that was constantly telling me that I wasn't reaching the bar. And for instance, my OCD, and this does happen with people with OCD, it kind of splinters off into shadow syndromes. And I developed an incredibly awful eating disorder, and it became full-blown anorexia nervosa. And the internal voice basically said, you know, if you want to be loved, then you need to be perfect. And for you to be perfect, you need to weigh a certain amount. So I'd get my weight down, and then, of course, the voice would say, well, you know, this is okay, but if you lost a little more, you'd be more loved and prettier and more accepted. So if you want to go for it, that's all you got to do. So I'd kind of be led into the darkness, not realizing that it was really my disorder taking over and basically pouring a cup of water on all my thriving joy, basically a robber of joy, a robber of time is what my OCD has been like throughout the years, and especially in high school.
And, you know, as I think about the world in which we are living, there is so much, not that the media is all bad or all good, but my goodness, there really has been certainly a push for you to see yourself as having to look a certain way, having to have a certain hair color, a certain lipstick, you name it, in order to be acceptable. And that's just from turning on the television, so which you could in theory turn off at some point. So to have it in your head and to have it all around you just as a natural course, I would think would have made the time even more challenging.
Yes. The days went particularly slow. It was maddening. I would sometimes go to the neighborhood church and just go sit up in the front pew and pray, and I really couldn't even explain why or what I was praying for, but I was so miserable and so trapped, and going back to the word hellish circus, I really did not know my way out. And it wasn't until I heard the words OCD and started to educate myself that I started to find my way out into a much more happy, joyous, wonderful, full, rich life.
Let's talk about community college for you. You describe it as loser land.
Yes, I certainly did. I was so distracted in high school on everything but my grades. So by the time everybody was on their way to four-year universities, I had to kind of slump myself along to the nearby two-year community college, which I was less than happy to be registered at.
Again, things were changing, and I'm just wondering, your parents, your siblings, your friends, did anyone say, wait a minute, this is the one who, you know, was always doing good grades and was the perfect child, and now her grades are dropping and something's different? Did that ever come up?
Well, you know, I think that the adults in my life were distracted with their own lives. My mother, for instance, was raising three children on her own. She was working, you know, 60 to 80 hours a week, and really a lot of that focus had to be on the job and being the breadwinner and keeping the lights on in the house. And my father was always, you know, off doing whatever made himself feel good. And it was kind of like I just flew under the radar into this dark depression, and I detached from my friends and just kind of went into this very functioning mode, waiting for the day to be over to stop some of the pain.
You know, in so many ways, as you describe it, it really sounds, to use your word, not only painful, but it sounds horrifying. It sounds exhausting. You talk about some of the things that you couldn't do. You couldn't touch a newspaper. You couldn't touch certain pens. You couldn't have your shoes touch your feet. So you had to wear shoes that were perhaps a size or a size and a half larger than what was appropriate for your shoe size. You couldn't wear certain fabrics. You had to have your tongue resting in a certain way in your mouth. It's just hard to imagine having that much pressure on you and being able to ever be okay. And you're clearly saying that there is an okay at the end of the tunnel.
Oh, absolutely. And I would say that OCD is very confining, very constricting, and it makes your world very, very small because you become very limited in what you're able to do. And part of being healthy and doing the learning that I've done and so forth is about becoming a fuller, more expansive, more expressive person that looks forward to the next moment instead of dreading it. And a big reason that I wrote the book, Leaving the OCD Circus, is because I know with OCD there's so much needless suffering that people do. And what I wanted to do was shed a light on the bully and really take the bully down piece by piece, whether you're a checker, a perfectionist, hand washer, anything that's blocking you, really, from experiencing a flow and reaching your potential, anything that's blocking your way that needs to get out of the way, I kind of tackle that in my book. And when I wrote the book, it was really because I felt such an obligation and a responsibility to share with other sufferers what I had learned. And I had read so many books by this time, and I've met with so many doctors. I was collecting vintage ephemera that was in some way speaking to me about my condition and my disorder. And I thought, I was able to carve and whittle my key out of prison, or as I say, the circus. And by showing people how I whittled my own key, it truly is my intent for people to whittle their own key and learn how to find their way out of whatever is trapping them.
Tell us about Dr. Kalb. Dr. Kalb was a significant force in your life. How did you come to meet Dr. Kalb, and what was that experience like?
Well, like I had said, my husband heard on the radio the PSA, and it was from the lovely and very proactive, wonderful organization called the International OCD Foundation. And on that PSA, they said, if you would like to speak with a specialist, there are specialists in your area. And so I was able to locate Dr. Kalb in Northern California, and he was such a warm, gentle, compassionate guy. I could tell just on the phone. And he said, would you like to come in and see me this afternoon? And I'm so glad that he did, because I might have become too afraid by day two to go see him. But he was available and he was open, and I drove myself there and met him. And that was really the first step in the right, positive, healthy direction.
When you met Dr. Kalb, was that when you were diagnosed with OCD?
Yes, it was. There is a test. I believe you can even look it up on the internet. It's the Y-box test, and that's Y like the word yellow, B like boy, O-C-S. And basically, you take this survey, take this test, and it lets you know in the land of OCD kind of where you are. And when I took the test, I was shaking to hand it back to him, because to me, I saw myself as so terribly flawed to have this condition. And I just started weeping handing it to him, because I could not hold the secret a minute longer.
Can you give us the name of that test once more?
Sure. It's Y-box. So Y like the word yellow, B like the word beautiful, O like Oscar, C like cat, S like Sam. So it's Y-box.
Okay.
And I don't know exactly what it stands for, but it is kind of tried and true. They may have even more sophisticated ways to measure now. But I know that one is very solid and very trusted amongst professionals.
When Dr. Kalb diagnosed you, was it a sense of relief, shame, curiosity, all of the above, none of the above?
You're absolutely right to say that there is kind of a multi-level of things going on. At first, just knowing that I had OCD was enlightening. And then what was really enlightening is when he said, Kirsten, you have a medical condition, and OCD is not your fault. And there's so much guilt that goes on with OCD, because you feel so broken and you want to make yourself right and you don't know how to do it. And when he said, it's not my fault, I felt this relief. I felt this pressure lift. And he said, you know, you told me the things that you've done in your life, that you've gone to college and you have a good job and all these different things. And he said, you're quite accomplished. How does that feel to do all of those things with only using 10% of your brain and having the other 90% tied up into OCD? And when I saw the math laid out like that, I became incredibly angry that someone was taking my other 90%. And I thought, my gosh, if I'm just existing with 10% and I have some lousy medical condition that's stealing the other 90, well, I'm going to fight, and do everything I can to get that 90% back to me where it belongs. So I've got one lifetime here, and I want 100% of the juice. I don't want anybody stealing it from me.
Now, typically when it's a medical condition, that is then followed by a particular treatment, surgery, physical therapy, and certainly there's usually medication involved. What did the doctor recommend for you?
Well, at first we just had learning exercises so I could come to understand what was going on and what OCD meant and how my brain was misfiring and so forth. And medication definitely can be very helpful to some people. Other people are very adamant and they don't want to go the path of medicine, and that's okay too. So what I've learned is that it's a combination of things that can bring the most success to freeing yourself from obsessive compulsive disorder.
One of the approaches that you describe in your book is exposure therapy. What exactly is that?
Well, exposure therapy, in a nutshell, it's kind of exposing yourself to things that you don't want to be exposed to because they flare up your OCD. So, for instance, the touching of the newspaper. I would avoid newspaper because I did not want to have the feeling on my fingers. And so in exposure therapy, you expose yourself to those triggers that are making you pull in and service your OCD. So you kind of challenge it, and it's nothing that you just go out on your own and start doing. That would be horrifying and terrifying. It really is little bit by little bit, and starting with, it's a hierarchy. So you start with things that disturb you the least, so things that you can accomplish and kind of push yourself. And then the more you go up in the hierarchy, the more things you're able to take head on. But it sounds horrible to someone with OCD because what they try so hard to do is not do any of those things that flares up the OCD. And what's interesting is being able to have it flared up and not do a compulsion is really what starts to bring some freedom.
The idea of exposure therapy, is it time limited, and once you do it for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, you're done?
Well, I would say with exposure therapy, you definitely get immediate results because you're starting to be able to do things that you were unable to do. So it's a little empowering in that regard. However, I would say that because, and everyone wants to know, are you cured from OCD, did you beat it, et cetera, et cetera. And what I can say, it's like being diabetic and you manage to it. So I'm in the driver's seat, OCD is in the sidecar all the time. And I do exposure therapy all the time to keep myself in the driver's seat. So I might do something and say, hey, old OCD might say, ooh, you don't want to touch that newspaper. And I go, oh, no, yes, I do, OCD. Look at me. Here I go. I'm touching the newspaper. And it's by doing those little things that you become empowered and you manage your condition and you really get on to a big, happy life.
Kirsten, you are married. You've referenced your husband a couple of times. And certainly with an experience like, well, any number of experiences, but something like OCD, which can really, as you've described, sort of get in there and really guide and control your life, it can also cause huge problems in relationships. We're going to take a break now, but when we come back, I'd like for you to sort of walk us through how you were able to negotiate your relationship with your husband, who, I got to tell you, sounds pretty fabulous.
He is. He's a wonderful partner.
Folks, we're going to take a break and we will be right back with Kirsten Pugash. Kirsten, tell us about relationships and the impact that you experienced in your relationships as you were struggling with OCD, initially not even knowing what it was.
Well, OCD was very much the person that I was having a relationship with, as odd as that might sound. So I would have relationships with other people in my life, but kind of OCD was the big bully that would always stomp in and ruin the day. And I found a very awesome, excellent friend 30 years ago, actually, is when I met my husband, at all places of the two-year community college. So that is definitely a diamond in the rough, and they are out there. Anyway, he has always been very supportive of my well-being and my mental health. And the more we learned about OCD together, the more we worked very hard to make sure that OCD did not have a place at our dinner table. And the fuller I became and the healthier, then that really parlays into the relationship that you have with your spouse. So we understand OCD, and we just say, not today, OCD, not today. You're in the sidecar. We're the ones in the driver's seat.
Do you literally say that? Do you use affirmations to help yourself through the process?
I would say I do, not at every occasion, but definitely I say things because I think it really imparts to myself that I'm darn serious. And when I say something out loud to myself, I do it sometimes adding my name. I read somewhere that adding your name really makes you pay that much more attention. So I might say to myself, you know, Kirsten, this is a really important moment. Be here now. Like, this moment's fleeting with your mother. And so really be here now, 100% connected to the experience. And then I go, oh, yeah, I got to get out of my head. I got to stop thinking about my to-do list, you know, all the things that we all do all the time. So I give myself gentle reminders, gentle little nudges of where I need to be.
Tell me about any recommendations that you would offer for someone who was in a relationship with someone who was dealing with OCD.
Well, for me, I really think that education and awareness, when you think about just regular life, becoming educated and becoming aware usually is a really good foundation of where to begin anything. And it's the same thing with OCD. It's not different, really, in any other way. So awareness, education, there's so much good information out there. When I was suffering with OCD, I would go to the library and I'd look up what I thought my symptoms were, and I could find bipolar and I could find manic depression and schizophrenia, and none of those things ever quite seemed to be the right fit. And now what's great about being in today's day and age is that there is so much great, wonderful information out there. And just like anything, you have to be very careful of the sources. However, if you use your best judgment and do your research, you can find some amazing information. And I would definitely say, as well as reading my book, Leaving the OCD Circus, get online and look up IOCDF, which is the International OCD Foundation, because you can do it anonymously and you can start learning and start understanding just what OCD is.
In relationships, do you recommend that someone share with a potential partner immediately, first date, this is something I'm dealing with? Do you wait a while and then bring it up, or do you just try to keep it hidden?
I would say that you just have to share when it feels right for you to share. But if you want to be in an open and honest relationship with somebody, they need to know what's going on with you. So I think to be open and be honest, maybe it's not on the first date, you know, but at some point I do think that it does need to be in the information that gets shared.
And what about employers? Would you recommend that someone tell their employer, or, again, try to keep it under wraps?
You know, I think that would be on a case-by-case basis. I think that seeking professional help and getting some advice from an expert would be the best answer there.
Okay. Tell us about the four R's, relabel, reattribute, refocus, and revalue. What's that about?
Well, when I was in hot pursuit to learn more about OCD, I was diagnosed at 32, and beyond meeting with Dr. Kelb and doing my exposure therapy and my cognitive behavior therapy, I also would go to bookstores. And I one day was at one of the large chain bookstores, and I saw the book called Brain Lock, and I thought, huh, someone's written a book about OCD, and it's called Brain Lock. That sounds like they really know what they're talking about, because that's what it feels like. And inside Brain Lock, there are the four R's, and it's kind of a very quick way to gather your thoughts when OCD comes knocking at the door. One of them is to recognize it. And when OCD grabs a hold of you and you're kind of in the trance doing these compulsions and these obsessions and you're looping and you can't find your way out, sometimes you just have to remind yourself, oh, yes, this is OCD. That is what I am dealing with. And really giving it a name and recognizing it before it comes in and does a number on you.
You know, the idea that you were dealing with this and truly struggling with this until diagnosed at the age of 32 is so big. I mean, it's just extraordinary, but not uncommon that it would take that many years for you to be able to find someone who was aware enough to give you a diagnosis that made sense, an accurate diagnosis, and then give you a path towards recovery.
Yes, and I would say with OCD, what I've experienced is I became a really darn good actress. And so I kind of had a parallel reality going on. There was the external person and what I would do to present myself or work or whatever needed to be done. And then I had the internal person that I was hiding. And so I became a darn good actress because I really didn't want anyone to find out just how broken I knew I was.
That takes a lot of energy, and that's a lot of...
It is, but and not to be all spiritual on you, but the God that I report to said, you did all this tremendous suffering and had this darkness and anorexia and just, you know, so many years of suffering. If you can turn this into something good for other people, that helps me understand what I've gone through that much better. And so I decided I'm going to take these years of education and knowledge and pain and suffering, and I'm going to remold it. I'm going to carve it. I'm going to turn it into something that can be very beautiful and instrumental for other human beings. And that really became the mission of why I got up and why I started writing, was to stop needless suffering.
And that work to stop needless suffering turned into leaving the OCD circus. Tell us what your life is like today.
Oh, my life is very full and wonderful, and I'm experiencing things that at one point I thought I would not be able to. And one of the things that I'm doing is I operate a business. I've been running a business for 12 years very successfully. And in this business, I can do my artwork and my creativity and really kind of, you know, stretch my creative muscles. And I have a good, fun time doing it. And at one point, that would have been outrageous and out of the question. I kind of hid out in my cubicle hoping that no one came my way. Where now, it's a lot different than that. I'm very happy to reach out and be extroverted.
What kind of jobs were you experiencing along the path before the diagnosis at 32?
I did a lot of waitressing, and so that was interesting. I worked at a variety of places, from the diner situation to the very elegant Italian fine dining. And I also worked a lot in sales and marketing. My degree is in communications and media studies. That's kind of where my natural interest brought me. And then I started to kind of develop my career The first job I had out of college, the first official job, was actually working at a cable company where I wrote, shot, and directed cable commercials, some better than others. But I did that, and that was kind of my kickoff into the quote-unquote real world, if you will.
It sounds like with all of these jobs that you've identified, certainly with waitressing and sales and marketing, the capacity to be surrounded by human bullies outside of your head who were telling you the same thing that was going on inside of your head seems to me like it would be very high. Waitressing, sales, marketing, lots of people around to tell you what you're not doing right, what you need to do differently, what you should have done better. How did you manage that?
Well, it's kind of like you take that stuff that goes on anyway and you plus it up many, many times to exaggerated portions. And so I was experiencing those things, but it's really heightened and amplified by the voice of OCD. So that voice comes in and makes something that might not be desirable, something horrible. And that's kind of the bully nature and the abusive nature of OCD.
So how did you deal with it?
Well, it was a painful existence, and I was morbidly depressed, and like Dr. Kalb called out, I was functioning with 10% of my brain juice, if you will, and the other 90% was tied up with my medical condition, and I was very, very, very ill. And part of my quest was to get that 90% back so I could have a full life and have full availability of my brain and my thinking and control my thoughts and be mindful. And so I've worked incredibly hard to kind of work on the tool, which is my brain, to get it healthy and to manage myself and do everything that I can to manage to OCD. It's similar to like being diabetic, and there's certain things that you know you need to do to take care of yourself. And just like any other condition, if you have fair skin, you need to wear sunblock. And people would argue that no matter what, you should wear sunblock. And that's not really asking too much. You just need to know what are those things I need to do to protect myself and have a healthy journey here on this planet we call Earth.
The experiences that you've described, bringing them present to today, are you taking medication today? Are you in therapy today? Do you involve yourself with support groups or educational groups today?
Yes, I do take medication. And something that people that have OCD will hear frequently is that their levels of serotonin are off. And I believe that is very true with myself, and I did find the medication to kind of give me two boxing gloves to fight and fend off OCD instead of, you know, having one arm tied behind my back. So for me, it's worked. I don't see a therapist on a regular basis. However, to get my medication refilled, I do need to at least have an appointment once a year just to kind of do a check-in and make sure things are going well and that the medication doesn't need to be changed and so on and so forth. I do have a website that I run and social media. I just went to Oak Park, Illinois, which was the town in which I went to high school and did so much suffering. And it was wonderful to go back as a helper instead of as a sufferer. And I did a presentation there, and we talked about questions and answers about OCD, and I did a book signing. And I've really been doing everything that I can to get the word out there and to do my job to help other people get on to their big happy lives faster than I got onto mine. And Pamela, I wanted to say by this radio interview, and I have done others, that having the platform to speak and reach people that are suffering or know people that are suffering, I just feel such gratitude in my heart that you have given me the opportunity to share with all of your listeners.
Well, it absolutely is my pleasure, and the read for me was very powerful. Tell us a website that one can go to get additional information about your book.
Okay, and if I could also say that it's very important with my book, Leaving the OCD Circus, that yes, it is a memoir, so sure, I share my story. However, more than anything, it's a self-help book where I offer tips and techniques, and I distill down complicated information that I received into very understandable, accessible information for people to take forward and use my book as a resource. To learn about my book and to learn about OCD and so forth, I invite people to check me out on social media or go to my website, which is leavingtheocdcircus.com, and you can find out more about my book there as well.
And can they find out more about the various social media in which you engage by going to the website?
Absolutely.
Great.
Yes.
Great.
And some of the basics that you would think are there, like Facebook and Instagram. And my communication in social media, I try my best to be inspiring and hopeful, because that's really the good stuff about life.
Absolutely. Kirsten Pragosh, author of Leaving the OCD Circus, your big ticket out of having to control every little thing. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, Pamela, the pleasure is all mine, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.